is the Packet Pushers Podcast, a virtuality where real engineers get together to talk, dissect, and review work life in the networking industry. It's nerdy, it's technical, and it's willfully obscure. Thanks for joining us here in our boardroom that is fully equipped with keen minds, practical and bitter experiences, and an overblown sense of what the future should look like. We attempt to tackle the issues that matter to networking engineers around the world. And at the same time, we try not to take it too seriously. So thanks for joining us. And speaking of people joining us, today with us again this week is Ethan. How are you this week, Ethan?
I am good. I had one of those weeks last week where I think I got more done than got put on my plate to get done. So that was positive. I had a lot of late nights just getting it done, but that was a good thing. Mm. Turned up some fexes finally. Actually have them running, taking traffic, and it went flawlessly. I had no issues whatsoever with that infrastructure. So that because of all the bugs people were telling me about I was going to get when I started turning up my Nexus gear, I was all apprehensive. But so far, it's been a flawless, simple, but flawless implementation. So ecstatic and happy to be here and recording on a very interesting topic today, which we'll talk about in a minute.
That's right. And, of course, I'm Greg Farrow. Mm-hmm. You can find me on etherealmind.com. I also had some interesting times this week, Ethan, when we went to a function where I was a judge for some network heroes in the UK. And I ended up in a penguin suit at the Lord's Cricket Ground in London.
As a result, network heroes. So what was the body that was recognizing these folks for their heroism?
So this is Spirent, actually. Spirent, which is the network testing people. They've decided that we need to, and they partnered up with the British Computer Society to help do the judging and so forth. And it is independent, which is nice. So even though they've sponsored the event, they're actually genuinely trying to do something to bring to the industry. So trying to share something with the industry, which is something I'm quite pleased about. It was interesting to meet, you know, obviously there was some corporate leanings into the testing industry, but they had some around cloud and networking and security as well, which was really exciting.
What, was there blood sport involved? I mean, it's network heroes. Come on.
How did this become a gladiatorial competition?
Okay, it's network heroes. Come on. Heroes.
And that, of course, is Michelle. How are you, Michelle?
I'm fine. And I was trying to think of what I did this week. Besides being overwhelmed with meetings and these collaborative efforts to get our different groups where I work to talk to each other, I can't really think of anything specific besides running a cable with somebody from the Unix team.
Well, if you're in a lot of meetings, that has that unfortunate sound of people now know who you are and expect you to be able to be involved in projects, and so your time is being scheduled for you. You're no longer under the radar, you're known.
I know. I had like 4 meetings in one day, and it's, I think, one of the reasons I get invited or I end up getting stuck with organizing them is because I have that social ability to do that.
That's not a win. Okay, and tonight we want to talk about quality of service and buffer management. And we're very pleased to announce that Jim Geddes has joining us today. Good evening, Jim. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I work at Bell Labs, just part of Alcatel-Lucent, and I was hired to work on immersive teleconferencing until one day about 2.5 years ago when I realized my home network didn't work the way I expected. In fact, I considered it broken. If you're going to do that from your home, and since I work remotely, that's sort of a given, I needed to understand why my network was busted. Before that, I was vice president of software at One Laptop Per Child, and people know me for the X Windows system, which I was one of the original authors of, and I was also the editor of the HTTP 1.1 specification through draft standard in the IETF. I've also worked on handheld devices and stuff like that, so I've been around.
Well, you've certainly done more than I ever have.
Yes, and
I'm probably
I was genuflecting, so I just wanted to. And the angels sang for a moment.
Well, you know, I'm one of these, you know, these old gray-haired guys, right? Much to my chagrin.
But do you have a Unix power beard?
My brother had a beard, and it was scruffy enough that I have never been tempted to try a beard. Sorry.
You know, he doesn't need the beard. He has the Usenix 1999 Lifetime Achievement Award. Wow. So there.
They're there. And I'm also very grateful for HTTP 1.1. It solved a lot of problems for me as well, I must say. Yeah. On a more practical note.
Well, it's also created a lot of problems too, so.
Well, that's just HTTP for you.
I don't like the protocol myself at all.
Which means that's probably why HTTP 1.1 was as good as it was. If they selected all editors of protocols by people who hated them most, perhaps they'd work better.
Quite possibly.
Well, the reason, Jim, we wanted to talk with you on the show, and thanks very much for joining us, is, of course, that about 2 years ago, as you said, you started to discover that your home network wasn't performing the way it's expecting. Now, we'll put a link to your blog, which is on WordPress, where you originally made some blog posts about the fact that you felt that there was something wrong with your Wi-Fi and performance wasn't right. And then you did what nobody else seems to have done, which was actually to apply science to it. Perhaps tell us a little bit about what drove you down that path.
I'd seen weird things with my home network for a good half dozen years and just never been able to put my finger on it. And so the difference is I stumbled across a really sort of trivial test and needed to make my home network work properly. And I worked on teleconferencing in the 1990s and know what decent latency is, knew what could how it could and should work, and was dismayed to find that some simple tests I was doing, rather than being in the 50 to 75 millisecond range, were like 1.2 seconds. And talking to somebody that's halfway to the moon really is a pretty lousy experience.
As somebody who lived in Australia for the first for the first 10 years of the internet, and Australia is on the wrong side of a 275 millisecond delay to America, I can promise you it's grim.
And I was seeing 1.2 seconds.
Yeah.
Right? So, and I limited my Wi-Fi out of that very early on. So this was just my broadband connection would do that with a trivial test, which was just copying a file at the same time as running ping. The network shouldn't work that way.
You're running a ping and you're doing an upload at the same time and you're actually getting echo replies, but they're taking greater than one second.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I'd had some, that was about 2.5 years ago. And about that point in time, or shortly thereafter, we had the third lightning strike near my house in 2 years that sort of blew up my home network. So I got to reconstitute it and didn't get back to it again until sort of late June. After futzing around for a few days to a week, I figured out how to reproduce exactly what I'd seen before and remembered just enough about capturing packets to try to understand what was going on, left over from having worked in HTTP in the 1990s. So I normally am not at one of these people who is just instantly pulls out Wireshark and does things, but I knew enough to be able to do that. So I took some data. What was really sort of dismaying was to find after 15 years that the tools haven't improved much. Which
you
is
just
really
summed
sort
up
of,
the whole networking industry. We still, we're being, 30 years into networking, and our best tool is traceroute ping.
I then, after wasting a week looking for better tools, take TCP trace, and because I want to plot this stuff up and see what in the world's going on. And I was very, very rusty. I hadn't done this sort of stuff for nearly 15 years. And after staring at it for a couple of days, I finally noticed that one of the plots was telling me that there were hundreds of kilobytes of data that were outstanding in the connection. This is over what should nominally be about a 10 or 12 millisecond path, and the TCP bandwidth delay product means that it should be a very small amount of data, and this was clearly completely broken. I also then, the next week, was down in New Jersey, got very similar information from very similar looking plots. The absolute amount of outstanding data was, was somewhat different, but everything looked the same. The classic TCP sawtooth didn't look like it should. It was different shape, and the period was insanely long. given that sort of path. So I'm scratching my head and don't know what to do. I'd also chatted with Rich Woundy at Comcast, who gave me a number of other interesting puzzle pieces, for which I'm eternally grateful. One of the things he pointed me at was the data that Berkeley had gathered, Netalyzer project. If those of you who haven't played with Netalyzer, you should. And in fact, you should routinely run Netalyzer every place you go. Any new network you sit down at, you should run Netalyzer and find out what your ISP has done to you. It tests more different things than any other single tool I know of. But one of the things that it tests, because there have been reports over the last decade or more of bad amounts of buffering, so they had thrown in a test to try to determine how big was the buffering in the edge connection or at the bottleneck link, which is really what you're testing. And so that the first publication of that data occurred at about the time, same point in time that I was doing my simple-minded, simple experiments. So I took my data and threw it off to a bunch of people I know and have known for quite a while in the networking community. As editor of HTTP, as you might imagine, in the 1990s, I was sort of a pretty popular guy and in the sense of everybody would bend my ear about this or that thing that had to happen. Sent this data out to a set of people, including Van Jacobson and Dave Clark and Dave Reed and Scott Bradner and so on, and said, "This looks really strange to me. What in the world's going on with this data?" They looked at this. We batted around on a mailing list for a week or two or three and came to the conclusion that it is exactly what people had been worrying about, had previously been called, at least Dave Clark had called this, the big buffer problem.
So all your data in flight, like when you were doing that that ping test while simultaneously uploading a file, and then some of your other tests where you found you had a huge chunk of data in flight when it, in fact, should not have been in flight based on what the normal TCP calculations would have been for the window size and so on. It's sitting in a buffer somewhere out there in internet in between point A and point B.
In this particular case, it happened to be sitting in my cable modem. But understand, we had at the same time the scatter plot, which courtesy of the Netalyzer guys is in my blog as well, which shows just how broken all of our broadband technologies are. There are problems in fiber and cable and in DSL. The only question is how much. All of it is badly overbuffered. And in fact, to give you an example, I know that Nick Weaver at Berkeley spent quite a while trying to find even a single instance of a cable modem that was, quote, correctly buffered, unquote, and was unable to find any. All of the broadband gear is overbuffered. The only question is what degree.
So when you talk about buffering, I think most networking engineers who are Cisco trained will talk about queuing and queue depth, since most of our audience is sort of focused around that. It might be worth sort of saying that buffering is queue depth effectively. Is that correct?
Yes, but I'm not – in this case, it's how many bytes. It isn't how many packets, because it's the length of time it's going to take to drain that queue. Usually when you think of queues, you think of things as individual packets, but different packets take different amounts of time to transmit.
Yes, because some packets might be 1,500 bytes and some of them might be 64 bytes, and it takes a different amount of time.
Exactly.
And you are actually talking about how many bytes can be exited. The thing to remember is that in TCP, your workstation can only transmit X amount of packets before it should get a signal back from the far end to say, my receive buffering is full, please stop. That's normal. That's the normal behavior. I send the receive, and then I send until the receive buffer of the destination is full, and then it sends back a thing, a negative ACK, to say stop sending. I've got to process this data.
Which is way larger than bandwidth delay product says it needs to keep the connection busy. Basically, a modern TCP will fill any size buffer you put in front of it, any size queue, given time. A single modern TCP will fill anything.
Okay, when you say modern, you're actually talking about things like Windows 2008 or later.
I'm talking about anything later than Windows XP, that as far as I know of.
Yes.
Anything that does TCP window scaling given time, the additive increase will cause it to go faster and faster.
It'll burst, even on a microburst, over a distance of, say, 200 milliseconds, it'll fill up that link for a short period of time.
It will fill and – it will keep it full. It will fill and keep it full.
Yeah, because it's an exponential curve up. So you send one packet, you get an ACK back. If it comes back in a good time, you send two. And the next
That's just during slow start.
That's right.
So I'm talking about after slow start, you do additive increase. But given time, the same. So what happens first is it fills it very rapidly. Then in fact, because it's grossly overshot because of the buffering, I actually see typically multiple drops, not just one. And then it slowly tries to creep up on the bandwidth, but it keeps going and going and going. What's been forgotten by engineers is that TCP presumes timely notification of congestion. And these buffers have destroyed timeliness.
Well, it's the point of TCP is that you should drop packets. You must drop a packet.
Drop or mark. Yeah. You could ECN mark them. Not typically being done today, but
no.
You need to do one or the other.
That's right. So normally what would happen is somebody would transmit packets, they'd burst up the slow start curve, exceed the available bandwidth, and then the far end would signal back, I haven't received some frames, and the sender knows to stop sending or to slow down the pace of the sending so that I don't overrun the available bandwidth in the WAN. When you start to insert buffers in the middle, then the overrun doesn't happen because the far end keeps receiving them even after they've been...
It doesn't see the loss that it was designed to expect
in a
timely fashion.
And so the sender keeps throwing...
the connection.
Sender keeps transmitting at that point and filling up the buffers. And so, but when there's 20 buffers along the line over the internet, so there's your cable modem,
or 200.
Yeah. And then there's your DSLAM, and then behind your DSLAM is your MPLS-PE, and then there's the MPLS-P, and then there's the PE.
Back up a second. What I'm talking about here is a single TCP connection over a single path.
Yep.
And so the thing that determines how fast it can go is its bottleneck link. So at any given instant, there is one bottleneck, not N of them typically. Which hop is the bottleneck may vary as the network conditions vary. But TCP is constantly trying to its performance to that bottleneck link, because the fact that the other ones are all – it's the slowest link you've got. And so trying to transmit any faster than that doesn't help you any at all. So what I've talked about here is buffer bloat in the small, in the individual path.
Yep.
You can also have an entire network set of buffers fill potentially. Certainly we saw that in the 1980s and 90s with the very bad core network congestion in that era, to which algorithms like RED and weighted RED were invented, okay, to try to attack that problem, that congestion problem.
Yeah.
The aggregate case can still happen as well, because you're doing what other people are doing to you doing in the network may affect what you can get, how much bandwidth you can get. But I was initially just talking about the single path, simple case.
All right. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And a single TCP will fill any size buffer. If it's a megabyte in size, if it's 10 megabytes in size, it doesn't care. Given time, it will fill it.
A big enough data set, a big enough pipe, and it will always overrun any buffer, no matter what you do.
Exactly. That's its inherent nature. Throwing more memory in, all it can do is turn into delay. The marketing guys have done a number on us. They've equated bandwidth to be speed. It's not. The colloquial meaning of speed is how long does it take me to get my job done? Faster to me is what's the elapsed time for me to complete what I'm trying to do? Internet applications are much more sensitive to latency than they are to bandwidth. And human perception times, guys, are as low as 20 milliseconds. It depends what you're doing. So if you want, for example, to be doing rubber banding of graphics over the network, and you want it to feel rock solid on your hand, your goal needs to be under 20 to 30 milliseconds. For typing to be apparently instantaneous. All the people who've done those studies, these studies were done many, many years ago and confirmed many times since, you've got to be well under 100 milliseconds. Okay? Mm. The telephony standard for what's acceptable for decent telephony, this is the total time, is 150 milliseconds.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah. So the MPLS people talk about 50 milliseconds being the acceptable human detection ratio for the failure of a session on average.
Occasional failures is one thing. Mm. But delaying things on a continual basis or what's called in multimedia world jitter, which is the latency plus how much does the latency vary, right? Uh-huh. That's what determines how close to real time can you hold a audio and video conversation. Okay, is the latency plus the jitter.
So if you've got a big buffer somewhere, then a packet gets stuck in there for 50 milliseconds. You're starting to
You've just burned one-third of your total budget for what's ever been considered acceptable quality telephony.
Yes, that's right.
Right there. And it's a budget. You never get it back. Bandwidth, I can get two circuits, bond them together. I can always get more bandwidth.
Can't get a buffer back.
You can never get back those milliseconds. And it's total end-to-end. It's everywhere from your microphone, okay, mm-hmm. to your operating system, to how big packets do you send out for audio as an example, right? To what's the delay getting your access to your Wi-Fi channel, to what's the delay contending for access in your broadband device. Speed of light across the internet plus whatever congestion there may be in the internet, and the same thing in the inverse direction all the way to the far end. It's a budget.
For you guys that are Cisco guys that are thinking about some of the different queuing strategies that come up, one of the ones that may be resonating with you right now is the low latency queue, because it is not a queue that's got a lot of depth. You pump voice traffic into that low latency queue, and it is dequeued on a very specific time slice so that packet jitter is reduced. All those packets for that voice are sent out, and I want to say it's a 10 millisecond interval if there's anything in that queue. It's no good if the voice packets queue up in to some ridiculous queue depth and then are delivered all at once when the router decides it's okay to send them or has line of capacity to send them, because then the voice quality is disintegrated at that point. So there's a direct parallel to what we're talking about here. When you've got other applications suffer like this with excessive buffers, and in fact, the term here that we've been talking around is buffer bloat.
And, you know, arguably I should have called it queue bloat. We didn't have a good term for it, so I coined a word, can I say. I'm guilty as charged.
It sounds good. It's got great resonance. Buffer bloat, you know.
Cube bloat. Yeah, well, it sounds slightly, like an animal.
It's slightly pejorative, which was intentional.
I used pejorative.
One question I have, what led us down this path? I mean, obviously, there was a decision on the part of vendors, folks that are making chipsets and doing router design or cable modem bridge design, as the case may be, to build pretty big buffers. You know, in the data center, there's a case to be made for buffers where folks will talk about a 10-gig switch and how big the buffers are in ports to contain burst traffic without it being dropped and so on, and they sell that, which is a completely different animal from traffic that's going across the internet. What were the decision points that got us here?
Now, how did we get into this mess is the question. I mean, early in the internet, we had the exact opposite problem, which was devices with insufficient buffer. And I remember discussions in the IETF working on HTTP about dial-up access devices which might not have enough packet buffers, such that you might experience excessive packet loss if there were too many packets of the same customer delivered at a time to that device. Unfortunately, Moore's law has gotten to us. Memory costs have gone through how many factors of two since then in terms of, you know, cost? In fact, you can't even buy a small enough chip typically these days, at least in anything but high-end routers. Something like your home device, you can't buy a small memory chip anymore. So to begin with, for a good 10 years or more, there's always been more memory available to the engineers involved than they need it. You never see this phenomena unless you saturate a link. It takes time, at least for a single TCP connection, to fill the buffers. So, if, for example, if you do a few second tests, if you're just doing simple short bandwidth tests, and we all are impatient, so we tend typically do these for relatively short periods of time, you typically don't see this in its full glory. If you let it run for 20 or 30 seconds, then you start to see this. The additive increase of TCP will have been filling those buffers long enough that you're starting to see a lot of latency in it. Memory got cheap. That's a major piece of it. The other piece is that where the bottlenecks occur has changed radically in this last 10 or 15 years. So in the 1980s to 1990s, we suffered from an internet that had insufficient bandwidth in the core, and very often most of the users in that era, prior to broadband, were connected via campus or enterprise networks to the public internet, which were pretty high bandwidth. And the queues would build in some internet router someplace else. So we thought with the invention of RED in 1993 that we had a handle on how to do the right thing. Unfortunately, as I can explain later, that turned out to be incorrect.
RED is in random early detection, the
that's right.
Queuing algorithm or dequeuing algorithm that's used to determine who goes next when the buffer's full.
Who gets a packet drop? The early part is important. You need to notify people to slow down sooner rather than later. The problem with tail drop is that notification is maximally delayed. Okay?
Hmm.
So memory got really cheap. Okay, the characteristics of the internet changed radically. In particular, we're now almost always next to a bottleneck link at home and or on our cell phones, as an example, okay? You've either got the broadband connection or the Wi-Fi link in your house. It will be the typical bottleneck link. Yeah, one of those two in your house. Similarly, in cell phones, your device is adjacent to the cellular link. So where this occurred changed. People were certainly not thinking about the fact that characteristics of the links changed radically. So we've already talked a little bit about this thing called the bandwidth delay product. That's what's required to keep TCP running at full speed in terms of amount of buffering. However, with wireless and to some extent with broadband, certainly also for cellular service, we don't know the bandwidth. And what's more, the path delay, we presumed by picking a number out of thin air, 15 or 20 years ago, well, if you want to go across the continent at full speed, then you better make that number 100 milliseconds. But this is really not so great either, because you may be talking to a CDN from home that's providing you your Netflix or your movie or whatnot that's 10 or 20 milliseconds away. Okay. So here's this rule of thumb, which traditionally had been the bandwidth delay product of how to figure out how to size your buffer. The bandwidth is now entirely variable, and the delay is variable. So we're taking two variable numbers. No fixed size buffer can ever be sized correctly. You can't do that. And by the way, whatever you size it to, that's the latency that you will be injecting into that connection when it saturates, into that hop when it saturates.
Yeah.
The desire of sizing the buffer, meaning you don't want it too big. You really want it small enough that traffic is no longer building up in the buffer and, in fact, is being dropped. So that TCP can adjust properly.
That's right. But the delay maybe is, 10 or 20 milliseconds, not 100 milliseconds. And the bandwidth can be anywhere from of order a megabit per second on a shared, Wi-Fi link and a conference to hundreds of megabits a second. You got something which can vary by two orders of magnitude in one direction and at least another order of magnitude there. So any fixed size buffer is nonsense. You're going to be often wrong by up to three orders of magnitude.
So you're not just wrong, you're massively wrong.
You're massively wrong.
Yeah.
Okay? So everybody has carefully tuned their devices. The practicing engineers are always being gold on bandwidth. So what do you think they do? Their bandwidth over a long distance. So the new device, the buffers are sized. If the engineer has thought about it at all, some do, some don't. they will ensure that the device can go at the maximum specified bandwidth, because we haven't been writing latency specifications into either, you know, into hardware devices or into terms of the service agreements, the SLAs in the networks. Since everything's been gold on bandwidth, what this means is the buffer will be at least it will be as big as that device to be able to run as fast as it can ever go, which might be 300 megabits a second. Mm-hmm. And then you plug it into an old system and you're running it at 10 megabits a second or 1 megabit a second. It's off by a factor of 100 or 1,000, you know.
Yeah, that's a bandwidth mismatch. That's where you have the core bandwidth is orders, three orders of magnitude greater than the edge bandwidth. And then you have the throughput versus good put argument, where throughput might be, you know, you might say that the pathway between you and the endpoint is 1 megabit, so your DSL connection might be 1 megabit per second, and that's your total throughput. But your actual good put can actually be 50% of that bandwidth, because half of it is traffic that should have timed out in a buffer. Like, I've done traffic analysis where 50% of my received bandwidth is so old that it's actually being discarded by the application receiving it. And the actual good put of that circuit is only 50%. So instead of actually getting a megabit of throughput, I'm only getting 50% of good put.
Well, what's really amusing is some of the latencies get to be so extreme that people time out long before the packets do.
Yes.
If you naively don't look at how long a packet has been rattling around the network and say, oh, I delivered the packet, I delivered, you know, 99% of my packets, but if 40% of them were delayed 20 seconds.
Yes.
Guess what? The person timed out long, long ago.
This is a problem on 3G networks, for example. There's a project undergoing right now on 3G networks, which is pointing out that on some 3G networks, only 40% of the packets are actually useful packets or being transmitted in a time of frame. But you're still being billed for everything that goes down your – so your mobile phone tariff – is being billed on the total amount of bandwidth being delivered to you, but they're not dropping packets early enough, and they're actually transmitting you 60% of your bandwidth consumption is crap, and should have been.
I've seen reports in a few papers on cellular systems of buffering up into the tens of seconds or a minute range.
A lot of those companies actually sell their products based on the concept of we never drop a packet.
Well, that's insanity. That says that packets can be arbitrarily delayed until the death of the universe. And
that's exactly what they sell. They literally do sell that, because you know who's buying them? Some idiot manager moron who just thinks, if I don't drop a packet, that must be good. And the engineer either doesn't know or doesn't have the current management fashion is to hate on engineers because they don't know business, right?
This is the irony of this is that these buffers often induce extra packet loss, either explicitly at the TCP level or by the phenomena of people timing out first.
Well, it causes a race condition, because if your packets are actually sitting in the buffer and they've timed out, and so the application has re-requested them. So now you've got the application, its response data is coming down, but so slow, by the time it reaches it, the application's re-requested it and it's been transmitted again.
Yep. People hit that reload button on the browser.
Or even applications timing out. They just assume that the TCP session is dead and then re-request, just issue a NAC and say, please retransmit, and then it comes flooding down the pipe. And trying sniffing these things with Wireshark is like a pain in the – because there's no death signal.
Well,
there's no signal says, you know, FIN or SIN or whatever.
Here's another aspect to it, which I didn't understand until last fall. I was chatting with Van Jacobson about TCP and buffer bloat, and he pointed out that the responsiveness of TCP to sharing a connection is quadratic to the delay. So if you've put in, say, 10 times too much buffering, it will take the TCP connection 100 times longer to get to a point where it's willing to share bandwidth. So not only do you have TCP elephant flows, but you have elephants that just are you know, bound to go in one direction no matter what you want to do. They're supposed to respond and, you know, start being friendly enough to share some bandwidth, but they don't, because when those big delays are put in, they stop being as they become much less responsive. That's a quadratic, and that was a surprise to me.
So once the buffer's wedged full, it's wedging shut and actually locking out.
the TCPs are going to keep sending. They aren't going to respond the way they should to what's going on. So they'll continue sending packets at possibly an excessive rate for a long time.
Mm.
It's a really pernicious set of circumstances.
Yeah, race condition. It actually, the worse it gets, the worser it gets. And it doesn't
right.
Solve itself. And it's largely to do with asymmetry, as you say, bandwidth asymmetry.
You know, there are problems all over. We see them all, you know, on a daily basis. Before we started recording this call, at least one of you told your kids to stop doing what they were doing.
Yep.
And that's routine.
Yeah.
The reason why you're having to do that is buffer bloat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sharing this link with you, but you can't tolerate the delay, and you don't want them to do bad things, so the recording will be bad.
Mm.
So in my household, it was the, "Daddy, the internet is slow today," which would usually be me causing the problem rather than the, "Junior, quit what you're doing. I have to make a phone call," which is the other side of this.
Yeah.
But you see this very all the time. People, you know, just about everybody I know who lives in a house with somebody else sees this. It's why very often you'll go into a conference and before the session starts, everything's fine and things start and everybody sits down and opens up their laptop and the network sort of collapses in a melted heap. You know, it's the same kind of phenomenon. In that case, it's much harder to understand. But again, the buffers will fill under load, and in that case, it may be aggregate. Remember, your devices are next to a bottleneck because we're now mostly wireless. And all of our operating systems are over-buffered. Windows, Mac, and Linux alike. I don't know the relative degree of the different operating systems, nor do I really care, because they're all badly excessive. So,
well, Windows 2008 and above has a 1 gigabyte TCP/IP variable size transmit buffer. So it'll hold a gigabyte of data if the memory's available.
Well, and what about... Could we talk a little bit about TOE and TSO and how that impacts it?
Let's start from the top, okay, and then go drill all the way down the stack until the packet's on the wire.
Mm-hmm.
First off, we've got applications. A lot of people writing applications don't think about latency and put buffering in them. Sometimes it even varies, is variable with what's going on. Applications sometimes suffer from buffer bloat. Going down the stack, the next level, we have the socket buffers. Recent TCPs are now, it used to be that those were sort of a finite fixed size buffer. I don't remember what they used to be in BSD Unix days. It's been too long. But those things now often auto-adjust. And so the socket buffers, if the delay goes up, will get bigger. We've got, and as you point out, that they may become megabytes or bigger just in things like socket buffers. Now we get down to what happens, you know, as data gets pulled out of TCP. And let's leave the TCP offload engines and the like aside for a moment. Underneath that, you typically have some sort of a queuing layer of some sort. Those queuing layers may have buffering in them. Sometimes that can be excessive, and/or sometimes those things might actually stack. And below that, we have the sort of device driver level, and often device drivers will have one or more packet buffers of packets inside. Sometimes it's for housekeeping reasons, and sometimes for other good reasons. So, for example, if you're doing 802.11n aggregation, you actually need a bunch of packets at once to put into a single wireless frame. So there's another set of buffering, sometimes significant, in the device drivers there. And then you get down to the actual, okay, now I figured out what packets I'm going to send out, some possibly in a frame. There can be also ring buffers, which are, when I looked at all three operating systems, it looked like most, the default ring buffer size in the hardware, this is hardware where you can put and queue a bunch of packets for transmission or reception, was 256 packets right there. Sometimes there's additional buffers hidden away inside of devices themselves underneath that or the like. Sometimes there's also encryption buffers. They tend to hide everywhere. There's just a lot of buffers all over.
So what I take away from that is you can't just fix it by fixing networking equipment as such. People have just put buffers in at every stack from the application down through the OS.
All the way through. Yep. So we've been attacking that in Linux over the last year. Mm-hmm. And the first major step forward is work done by Tom Herbert at Google, which is byte queue limits. Mm-hmm. Which dynamically adjusts the ring buffer usage so that it doesn't necessarily have a ton of packets in the Ethernet NIC when unnecessary. So, for example, if you're transmitting a pile of 1,500 byte packets, you need way fewer packets to keep the hardware busy, committed to the rings and the hardware, than if you're sending 60 byte packets. Byte queue limits attempts to adjust all of that. In terms of the queuing and the queuing layer in the operating system, in the case of Linux, we now have the AQM algorithm called CODL and FQCODL. Let's leave that aside for the moment. We'll come back to that later. Another thing which is just going into Linux now is called TCP small queues, TSQ, that Eric Dumazay has been doing. Mm-hmm. Again, that's in that case, it's attacking the buffering going on in the TCP layer to reduce its excessiveness and make it happens. So modularity is great, but unfortunately, we've not thought through buffering carefully at the systems level in our systems.
Yeah,
you may have noticed. Well, I mentioned that Wi-Fi might have a pile of packets. We haven't gotten that one yet. Though we've, for at least one of the common wireless chips, we've reduced the problem. Right now, the next major thing to attack is Wi-Fi, and it's going to be a lot of work because the design is harder to put in the direction we need to. And that's just one operating system. Okay, all the operating systems will have similar, not necessarily identical, issues to grapple with. Because there's a pile of buffers hidden in various places, and people have not been thinking about latency.
Well, I know I haven't. I've always thought that network latency was the answer. And if I was to solve the queues with RED or those sorts of things, then I'd be on my way to solving those problems.
It's more than just the AQM in this case, because there are other places where buffers hide. As you were pointing out, sometimes the operating systems, TCP, may allocate arbitrary amounts of socket buffering for you.
Yeah.
Not necessarily what you...
And how is that interacting with the offload engines?
Well, offload engines are a different problem. I've always been extremely skeptical of things that actually do TCP offload as opposed to just segmenting packets to transmit. The wheel of reinvention, those devices haven't necessarily worked out. Yeah, people have been trying to do that since the 1980s. And so one of the problems right now is it's really not nice if you're a server and you send a burst of packets into the internet at line rate. Okay, so now we might have 10 or 50 or maybe even 100 packets that spew out of some data center. And the core of the internet is often, not always, but often well run and will not encounter a bottleneck until it hits the head end of the poor customer's broadband gear, where it comes at a gigabit per second and you have 10 or 100 packets back to back coming in. And that pile of packets gets dropped in to a bloated queue right at the far side of the broadband bottleneck. Now, if I have some other poor little VoIP packet, lonely little VoIP packet that might want to get to my house, right now, your broadband provider gives you exactly one queue. Your poor little VoIP packet just got stuck behind maybe 10 or 100 packets.
Hmm.
In the internet, if on an end-to-end path, there really is no notion of traffic differentiation, where is my understanding. Whereas in an enterprise, we can mark traffic with DHCP. We can pump that traffic into a queue if we need, and then use RED to determine who's getting dropped first and how we're going to drop that traffic. But on the internet, everybody's an equal. Oh. Is that fair to say?
Right. Today's broadband gear is typically giving people exactly one queue without any sort of classification or fair queuing or anything. What's more, it's bloated. So once the packets get dumped into that queue, you've done head-of-line blocking. You've done basically a short-term denial-of-service attack on that poor customer. Okay. Part of what makes us particularly pernicious are things like some of the broadband gear some of the broadband services are highly asymmetric in bandwidth. And so they do, some of these devices do evil things like, rather than giving you your ACKs for your packets, they'll merge the ACKs together and you'll get one ACK for a pile of packets. So when that ACK gets to the back to the data center, that will release another burst of line rate packets to that poor customer again. And now that's interacting with some of this offload stuff. So now I get these bursts coming across the network to go splat at your broadband head end.
So are you saying that the TOE and the TSO on the server side will actually make this worse?
It will make this worse because we had thought that we were going to get ACK pacing, but courtesy of a lot of our broadband gear, we don't necessarily get ACK pacing. What's more, you can get what's called ACK compression occurring in the broadband link because of packets piling up in that delaying those ACKs in the return path. So you can look up what ACK compression is. These effects are tending to cause these nice line rate bursts to arrive at customers' head ends to drop into this single bloated queue, which blocks everything else you might like to do. All I can say to data center guys is you should be observing what you're doing to your customers and what they might like to do with their line. You know, a benchmark of how quickly do you get the packets out of your data center is not a good one. The question is how long does it take the information to get onto the user's screen correctly transmitted, right?
I think there's a lesson there even for enterprise guys that are doing traffic engineering, if you will, for their company, as opposed to doing something that's at a service provider and doing traffic engineering there. In the enterprise where you can classify your traffic, I just kind of was thinking about random early detection and the standard practice there. If you say you set up IP precedence or DHCP value to inform RED who should be getting dropped first, if you make your buffer too big, you could be doing that exactly the wrong way, where your high priority traffic is not getting tail dropped. It in fact is building up hugely in the buffer, ending up resulting in a negative impact to your application that's running across your enterprise.
Well,
so it's,
let me first make the following observation. Classification doesn't solve buffer bloat. It only moves it from place to place. It says who is suffering, not that problems aren't occurring.
Yeah, well, and that's actually a point I'm making for those of us that have a very granular control of the enterprise, our enterprise networks. There's a temptation, if you've got hardware that supports it, to make a very large buffer because of that bad way of thinking that if I never drop a packet, that's a good thing. If I never drop this very important traffic, that's the best possible thing for the application, when in fact we can make buffer bloat on our own inside our own little enterprise networks.
And for a voice, if you delay that packet 100 milliseconds and normally it should be at 20, all you've done is cause pain and suffering to the voice under load. Again, a lot of this happens because people typically test on an idle network and don't necessarily actually saturate it. You have to saturate a link before you see problems.
That's right. Yeah, QoS policy doesn't take effect unless you've actually got a point of congestion where the algorithm's got to kick in and do something.
Right. So, you know, there's a lot of things that have to think about. And any network that is and or device and or link that has not been tested under full load, where you're monitoring the latency at the same time as you're doing other things, you don't know what is going to happen. What this means is exactly what we observe. We are lemmings that fall off cliffs. We have performance cliffs all over the internet. The internet was intended and designed so that if there's only half the bandwidth we need right now, that things should take twice as long. Instead, we now have an internet where everything works great until we saturate the link, and then the delays go through the roof to the point where the network becomes useless. So we now are living in a much more fragile internet than ever intended. It should degrade gracefully, and we now have network links that just, in effect, stop working.
Do you think that exacerbates denial of service attacks?
Haven't thought about denial of service attacks. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, clearly, you know, I mean, it depends where you're trying to DOS someone. So I don't know. I haven't thought about denial of service.
It makes it more, if you're saying it makes it more fragile, then maybe that's why, definitely an interesting thought.
Now, the other thing which is not so much fun is that the buffering is so large that TCP is, how to put it, TCP, if it doesn't see a drop in finite time, eventually we'll start trying to find a new operating point faster than an additive increase. And so, you know, we really have a situation where we are operating the internet in a part of its flight envelope, if you will, that has never even been simulated. We don't know how the internet will behave. It's really a tribute to TCP that things sort of work at all under this circumstance.
I've always said that about the internet. The internet's a mastery of, you know, if we just keep believing in it, it'll keep working some days.
Well, right. And, of course, I somewhat lose sleep at night at times about will it keep working, because we are operating it now in a way that it was never intended, not designed for.
And for which there's no easy fix, by the way. You can't.
Well, I mean, I think we have both mitigations possible immediately, and I think we have now know how to solve the problem, but okay. We thought that in the 1990s, and we might be wrong again.
How to solve the problem, are you alluding to AQM and the Caudill algorithm, at least in part?
Yes. So, you know, that's still, you know, very much news in progress. So not all is done there. And I won't claim it that Caudill is a panacea. It was designed and simulated for the edge of the network. And whether it's appropriate everywhere or can be made to work is much less clear to me. Time will tell.
I think you get into some of how that works then. I mean, if I recall, it's been a while, I'll be honest, since I read that through that white paper. But my recollection is it has the ability to adjust to changing parameters.
Yes, it's intended to be a no-knobs AQM, you know, nothing that you'd have to tune in regular operation. The fundamental issue with RED and why it's not liked by a lot of people and not used in many places where it should be right now is it's got three parameters you have to set. And it can hurt you potentially if you set them wrong. The only time it matters is when you saturate the router or thing that you're adjusting it for. So here you're setting parameters in advance for a condition you normally don't want to be operating in. And it might hurt you. So as you might imagine, its reputation has been that it's a pain in the ass and do we really want to run it anyway? So there's anecdotal evidence that there are a fair number of ISPs who just don't run RED at all or similar AQM algorithms. And given the situation with RED, I can sympathize, even though it may be the best tool they've got right now for a lot of congested networks. And I wish they would turn it on. And I've certainly seen routers in some people's networks where it was very clear that the ISP had congestion in their network and they were not running RED. or any EQM algorithm at all. So I was seeing bad delays at a particular points in their network. So in any case, RED's a defective algorithm, and that was a piece of this puzzle. And when I say it's defective, that's what Van Jacobsen, who's one of the original authors of that algorithm, will tell you. There's a couple of funny stories about that. Kathy Nichols and Van tried to publish the fact that it was fundamentally flawed several times since 1999, when Kathy one day walked into his office and proved to Van that there were several fundamental flaws in the RED algorithm one afternoon. The first attempt at this, you can go dig up the paper on the internet, because it did escape from their hands. It's called RED in a Different Light, and it was submitted for publication. And unfortunately, Van used the picture of a flush toilet to explain TCP's servo system. This apparently offended one of the reviewers in the conference, and the paper got rejected.
It all depends on what was in the toilet.
Well, it was just a nice physical analogy to how TCP works. So he told me that story once, and then several months later, he told me the second story for the second paper, which is really quite amazing, because it's like that one's never escaped in the internet. I have a copy of it on my laptop, but we don't want to confuse people. We know it's broken, so it's of historical interest. It was like a 35-page manuscript, and they submitted that paper for publication. I forget its title, and it came back with a review which said, "The results in this paper can't possibly be right. The authors are advised to read the fundamental literature in this area, e.g. Floyd and Jacobson, 1993.
And of course,
the worst failure of in this case is Nichols and Jacobson, yeah. On the paper. Yeah. The worst failure of peer review I've ever heard of. Mm. And the conference paper chair should be shamed forever for that one, because that's part of what a good chair will be doing, is to try to catch mistakes like that.
Mm.
So I don't want to discourage people from, you know, using AQM algorithms they have in hand if they've got a congestion problem, and there are certainly ISPs out there who should use the tool they have available. Okay,
so you're saying RED is better than nothing.
RED can be one tremendously better than nothing. Okay,
but so don't take this as an endorsement to actually turn off RED. Continue with RED, but understand that there's better.
If it's working for you, or you've got congestion, you've got to control today in your network.
Yep.
You know, you probably ought to be dealing with setting it up and tuning it. So don't take what I've said that RED is bad as we should immediately go around our network and turn it all off when it might get you into a tremendous amount of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. RED applied to a badly sized buffer is a bad thing. But you can if you know all the components, you can tune it to work to your advantage.
Right. And the problem is, and why we didn't spend any time trying to make RED work for the edge of the network goes back to what I was explaining before. We don't know what the bandwidth is. If you look at tuning RED, you have to know what the bandwidth is. You have to have some idea what the delay is. We don't know either. And so at the very edge of the network, where there isn't any aggregation of traffic, RED won't work. So it's not something I can just turn on in my laptop and be happy, okay? As an algorithm, I can't ever, since the bandwidth I'm typically doing is wireless, it's not going to be helpful for me. Same thing goes in a home router, okay? So we've spent no time, or actually no time at least from a theoretical basis, we've known that we can't solve the problem in the edge of the network with the existing algorithms. Okay?
Yeah.
Because they're all based on queue length.
And we can't know what the queue length is. You can't calculate the queue length because you don't know the delay or the bandwidth of the shortest or the weakest
path.
And the
bandwidth is always varying. What matters is how, and the fundamental insight of Kathy and Van's new algorithm is to timestamp the packets and just observe how long the packets have been in the queue. Okay? So it's a different class of algorithm than we've tried to do in the past.
Now, timestamping them like using the TCP options field or something like that, or?
Just you receive the packets, and put them in the queue. You find out what time it is and record what time it is as it goes into the queue.
Okay. And then the value is timestamped where? Just locally significant to the device?
Yeah, that's all you're caring about. How long has the packet been in a queue? That's one of the fundamental ideas in CODL. And that's why it's a different algorithm, different class of algorithm than what we've had before.
Yep.
Makes sense.
So, in any case, it works pretty well over the range that Kathy simulated it on. Which is to say, smaller, moderate numbers of flows over anything from of order a megabit per second up to the 100 megabits per second. That's something of order what she simulated before publishing it. We've noticed now that we have real implementations, some problems elsewhere. I don't think they're insoluble, but I think we're going to have to tweak on it a bit more. People, of course, immediately, because AQM has been a problem in even big routers, wanted to run it on very, very high-end routers, and we've noticed problems if there's a whole pile of flows that it doesn't seem to be pushing the queue length down as quickly as it should. So there's some more work to do on it. Right now, at least in the area in which it's intended, which is the edge of the networks, it works really, really well.
So okay? When you say edge of the network, you mean people's home Wi-Fi, their home routers, their DSL modems, whatever they want to call them?
Your laptop, your cell phone, all the places we needed something in the edge of the network. It works really, really well.
Yep. Okay? And but that's because, as you spoke earlier, that's because that's the point where most likely the delay will occur. That is, the last hop in the network is the point overall will have the least bandwidth and the most congestion.
Well, that's where the home users see that. If you're inside a corporation, you may see problems in lots of other places too, right? So it's not guaranteed that the bottleneck is going to be in that environment, but it's a place that we all observe it today. It may be where the worst problems are, but I'm not sure. People just haven't necessarily pushed on things enough You really have to look under the logs or under the rocks. The buffers hide in lots of places. Part of why I've had my talk says dark buffers in the internet is you don't see them until things saturate. So just because you don't observe any problems today, if your network configuration changes and your bottleneck changes to someplace else, you may find that you went from a situation where your queues were well controlled to one where it's uncontrolled.
Yeah. I'm also thinking of things like content delivery networks whose server side might well be having very deep buffers in their caching engines, and media streamers and teleconference units, that tend to have very much.
Right. And so for some of this, the sad thing is that things like if you watch your movies, they aren't doing, they call it streaming video. It's not streaming video. It's chunked video.
Yeah.
So if you actually look at what, for example, Netflix might do to you, to your network, what it does, at least when I've looked at it on looking at the bandwidth charts on OpenWRT, is every 10 seconds it runs the TCP connection as fast as it can to grab the next chunk of the video to you. And so, of course, what this is doing is potentially inducing some amount of latency into your home connection every 10 seconds. Then it goes away again.
That must be its way of handling the buffers, because it must be pumping all the buffers in the path at that point.
Well, right, and since the network doesn't respond today well, and you may remember earlier that I was talking about this quadratic behavior of TCP deciding to share bandwidth, the poor video streaming guys, if there's some other elephant flow over your broadband connection, it doesn't want to get out of the way in a timely fashion. So they sort of have to buffer a lot more data than they ought to, because they may not be able to get it when they need it, right?
And then the customers blame them, not the network, because it's a video problem. It's not a networking problem at that point.
So we've got the situation where the buffering has made a pile of things worse and worse with time. Hmm. Okay, so as the buffers have gone up, you know, this does, if we just go back to the packet stack we were talking about before, you know, you can induce larger buffering in your TCP stack, but it's also been encouraging application writers to similarly to work around the broken network. Okay,
it's very trendy amongst the application people of today to use caching extensively in everything, and caching in the networking is buffering. And it's becoming like a mantra for them, cache everything everywhere you can, because that's the only way you can scale and get performance. And so I'm not, you know, delivering this message is going to be hard.
I consider caching somewhat different than buffering, so let's not go down that rat hole.
I know. You can what I'm saying is I think most developers would mistake the two.
Right. Yeah. So there's another aspect of this which people don't commonly realize. So if you look back at the history of over the last decade, the thing that triggered the current debates around network neutrality was the deployment of BitTorrent. So if you do a little bit of – just spend a few hours looking at the history of this, what deployed when, it turns out that at the time that BitTorrent deployed – the buffering in the broadband devices, for example, cable modems, was already very high. That was the first application which people typically just left running in the background. Mm. Okay, you download a movie and it would start uploading to anybody who wanted it. That would saturate your uplink, which typically was provisioned at a tiny fraction of the downlink. If you go through the math of how big the buffers were, the 1.2 seconds that I observed was with a 2 megabit per second uplink with actually a modem that had comparable buffering to what was already provided by cable carriers to their customers. Okay? Mm-hmm. And but rather than having a 2 megabit uplink in that era, typical customers might have as little as 384 kilobits per second. So rather than 1.2 seconds of buffering, okay, the size of that buffer in time would have been something like 6 or 7 times worse. We would have been looking at 7 or 8 seconds with the identical device. Okay?
Yep.
Just because 384 kilobits versus 2 megabits, right? So when the ISPs went to understand their problems, what was happening to them was their phones were ringing off the hook with support calls. When they went to look, they would look at what traffic was going on in the customer's line, they would see BitTorrent.
Yep.
Okay?
And it was then pumping all the buffers.
The reason why it was causing the service calls was the network was already broken. We already had excessive buffering in the network when that occurred. So both sides of the network neutrality debate need to take a giant breath and step back a bit. The network neutrality advocates need to understand that there can be deployment of new applications which may tickle real problems in the network. And a ISP may need to take action, possibly quickly, to manage the traffic in the network for the benefit of all their customers.
Yeah, because you're saying is BitTorrent was burning up all the buffers, and therefore the ability of a TCP, and BitTorrent was largely UDP, and so it wouldn't...
In that era, it was TCP, okay?
Yeah.
And lead that is a recent phenomenon and a different discussion. We'll leave that aside. So BitTorrent wasn't the fundamental problem. The root cause of BitTorrent has got at least a couple of things that caused it to be disliked by ISPs. But the big one was their phone beginning to ring off the hook with service calls. Mm. Okay?
Yep.
And so while I'm very much in many ways for the concept of network neutrality, there are times, God forbid it ever be in secret again, that something needs to be done and done pretty quickly to control what may be a rapidly deteriorating situation. This is an interesting problem because right now we don't have any social mechanisms for, if you will, even necessarily confirming what the real root cause of a problem is, nor any requirement of ISPs to actually report operational problems.
Yeah, this is one of these things where you actually want government interference to force reporting and gain visibility of the challenge. But in America, certainly, you wouldn't be allowed to have government interference because of the hysteria it would create.
Well, be that as it may, I don't believe there are mechanisms anywhere in the world that are escalating problems necessarily to the right people to diagnose them. And it's not because of the competence of the people involved. In the case of Comcast, who took it on the chin about this, I've met many of their senior people because of buffer bloat. They're all really sharp people.
Yep.
They missed it. But we all missed it. Okay?
Mm.
We all missed it. We all made the same mistake. Okay?
Well, we all assumed it was working. I mean, until I read your blog 2 years ago about buffer bloat, and then it all seemed to be just coherent. It was all kind of obvious, really, you know.
So I think historically, though, there's been the attitude that you mentioned earlier, Jim, which is we're just going to throw more bandwidth at this thing.
But that will never work because there's always going to be a bottleneck. Okay, we can't engineer infinite bandwidth all the way to the edge. It's not economic, and every time we up the bandwidth, we have to increase the minimum amount of buffering. The fundamental issue is we can't have static-sized, stupid buffering anymore. Just throwing more bandwidth at it cannot fix this problem.
The only way we could fix this with more bandwidth is to have some sort of in-channel signaling to say how much bandwidth is there between the two endpoints so that you could extract information. But that breaks the stateless nature of the TCP. We don't want to have end-to-end signaling of TCP sessions.
But it's not just that. It's really hard to do when you get to shared medium like, you know, wireless mediums.
Well, right? Yes, but also importantly, you've also got, changing 8 billion computers in the world isn't going to happen overnight. And it's been hard enough to get HTTP 1.1 accepted. HTTP 2.0, which is a layer 4 protocol, which you think everybody would leap on for the advantages, has been fundamentally ignored.
Well, then again, people ignored a lot of the stuff we did in 1.1, which might have made the situation less bad. Ironically, that plays into an aspect of buffer bloat that most people aren't aware of. Okay? So, I should have put this on the agenda, but here's the story there. So in the original RFC 206A 2616 that I was editor of, there was a requirement that between a particular web browser and a particular web server, there be no more than TTCP connections opened at once. Okay?
Yep.
That restriction has long since been ignored, starting probably 6.8 years ago when the performance wars as opposed to feature wars finally broke out. That got ignored. And then there's this phenomena called, and so a modern web browser will, in the name of getting its bits faster, will open typically of order 6 or 8 connections at once to a particular name. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what this has done right off the bat is that's diluting the, since there isn't congestion state sharing between TCP sessions, it's diluted the congestion information by a factor of order, 3 or 4 over what was intended.
Mm-hmm.
six over, you know, of order six over 1/6 of what it was intended with one connection. And then there's this phenomena called website sharding. Okay. There are websites which deliberately put, typically image heavy websites, which put their images on multiple different servers. They may be co-located in the same machine room. They might even be on the same identical machine, but they'll be under a different name.
Oh, yeah, no, that's very common. Web performance people will tell me, despite my protestations to the difference, that they reckon that their web performance shows that if they can distribute their application over 10 to 30 different servers, that client load times accelerate.
Some of those people are actually not observing what's happening at the customer's end. They're observing packets leaving their machine room, which is not the same thing as a lapse time to the poor end user or what happens to their poor broadband connection. In any case, net result is you can have many tens or in certain websites even with the hundreds of TCP connections that get opened close to simultaneously. Mm. You get the initial window's worth of data back from each of these connections.
Which is small.
So we'll take, it's just like 4 today, though there's proposals to change it to 10 packets.
Yep.
And so now we take what might be, you know, let's be conservative, 30 TCP connections, we multiply by 4. That's 120 full-size packets leaving the data center at the same time. Mm-hmm. They're leaving that data center almost certainly at a line rate burst. So they'll arrive across the internet at your broadband head end, typically in a burst that's something like that, where they go into these excessively buffered broadband head ends.
Yep.
Head of line, can you say head of line blocking for anything else? And remember, you're only getting one queue at your broadband head end.
Yeah.
So if you wonder why there are dropouts in your Skype or VoIP connection, mm-hmm. okay, it's usually that. Somebody in your household, you or somebody in your household, hit an image-heavy web page. And a burst of packets.
A burst of packets
splat.
Overruns the buffer queue at the DSLAM in the local exchange.
It may not overrun it. Yeah. These things are, there's often quarter megabyte, half a megabyte, even a megabyte of buffer, you know, who knows how much buffering's at the broadband head end. There's often enough that you won't necessarily observe packet loss at all.
Mm.
What you'll observe is head of line blocking for hundreds of milliseconds at a time.
The queue might fill up for 300 milliseconds because there's all that web traffic ahead of your voice data.
So I've observed that kind of blocking on a 50 megabit per second broadband connection to my house, as it's now at 50 megabits a second. Actually, Comcast just turned it up to 100, but be that as it may, if I remember the numbers right, I'm seeing anywhere from 150 to 300 milliseconds. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And of transient behavior. It's head of line blocking on certain websites. So your poor, you know, think about what you're doing to your poor customer.
Okay? Yeah, the customer's getting the data. The website's actually probably loading faster, but.
No, I think a lot of those people are observing how fast do they leave their machine room. But if the bottleneck link is their broadband connection or their Wi-Fi connection, it doesn't matter how fast it left the machine room. What matters is how long did it take to get across the bottleneck link.
Yeah, how long did it take to render?
From the client side to see what your actual latencies are.
Even if they did live testing, that would be interesting because they would actually do it on an empty line. They wouldn't do it on a line.
They won't be observing latency. So God forbid that you have a customer who might like to have their telephony to work at the same time or not get fragged in the game they're playing. These transients are the death of interactive low latency applications.
Okay? And that, children, is why we can't have nice things. Jim Jim, I think we've probably taken this just about as far as we can get in a single session. I'm very keen to hear what CODL, as you name it, as an advanced queue management algorithm.
Not, Yeah. It's pronounced Cuddle. Why don't we do one more topic today?
Okay.
Which is, what can you do today to suffer less? Okay. If you are a person, you're having problems, what can you do right now? And why does it work? Okay. In your house, you have broadband service. Okay.
Yep.
So what you need to understand is there's two potential bottlenecks in that scenario. Your broadband connection or your Wi-Fi connection.
Yep.
So there are actually four different buffers that can be at play depending upon the direction you're going.
Yep.
Your broadband head end. In your home router, there's a queue waiting to go to your laptop or cell phone or whatnot that you're doing, your tablet in your house. And similarly, in the other direction, it's in your device upstream, because remember, all the operating systems are broken. Similarly, at the just before the broadband connection. Okay, so we got four buffers. So what in the world are you to do? Okay, to begin with, let's simplify. So what we're trying to do here is to end up with one bottleneck link, where we can keep the buffering to something semi-sane.
Yep.
So the first thing you do is you over-provision your wireless so that you always have, no matter how many people are using it or where you are in your house, more bandwidth available in your wireless than in your broadband connection. Ironically, the situation where getting more bandwidth from your broadband provider could make your home network work worse, because if it turns the bottleneck back into the into the wireless, you've just got your problem back in a different place, right?
Yep.
Again, upping the bandwidth isn't necessarily going to get you better service, ironically, and this is a good example of that. Okay.
Yep.
So first thing you do is you make sure you have stunningly good signal strength everywhere in your house. And, if you've got, since 802.11g only runs at best 20 megabits a second, if you've got 10 or 20 megabits of broadband stuff, you really ought to be running 802.11n, okay?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have 54. Yeah.
All right, so you stop using 802.11g because it probably doesn't have enough bandwidth in at least one direction for many or most modern broadband circuits. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And the whole point here is we're trying to make that since we can't do anything about your home router right now or your operating system right now, we want to make that not be the bottleneck. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So now, what do we do about our broadband connection? What you do is you will notice on many or most routers, on a page often called QoS, a field in which you can set the bandwidth. So what you do is you set that bandwidth to, in my experience is, you can set it to about 70% of what your ISP actually gives you. Not necessarily what you claim, since DSL is often actually not getting what they claim they're selling you. Yeah, you actually need to understand what they're actually provisioning. Okay,
yep.
So you set those values to about 70% with local router because you don't have good AQM going on, and that's putting an artificial bottleneck in the home router. It also happens to take out one of the big pieces of buffer bloat in the upstream direction, which happened to be is often the queue inside of Linux, since most home routers are running Linux. The P5OFS line discipline has got 1,000 packets of buffering right there.
You're going to lie to the router, tell it about how much upstream bandwidth it's got, which is going to change the math, which is going to end up in a buffer that's smaller.
Yes, you've got an artificial bottleneck so you're keeping all the buffers empty as much as possible. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you do that, then you will get rid of much or most of your problems overnight. You can't get rid of the transient phenomena I was describing just a moment ago. You have to give up things like Comcast Power Boost, which is where they give you some extra bandwidth for a period of time. But you stop having the daddy, the internet is slow today, or junior, stop doing whatever you're doing so I can make my phone call, whatever it is in your house.
Mm.
Okay? Those are the two things you have to do. You have to do both because you've got two different bottlenecks. if you're a real geek, then you might want to start playing with OpenWRT and or CiroWrt, which is an advanced build of OpenWRT, in their next release, where we're starting to actually attack the real problem in the home router. But remember, your operating system has to get fixed too. And so unless you're a Linux geek where you might be able to do things in the short term, you're at the mercy of your operating system vendor to fix the upstream direction in your device, in your laptop or cell phone or tablet.
I wish you good luck with that. I mean, Microsoft's had enough troubles just updating the drivers in, you know. I mean, Windows XP was identified the maximum throughput out of Windows XP under absolute perfect conditions using bandwidth delay product is less than 30 megabits per second. It doesn't matter what you do with Windows XP, that is the maximum it will ever run because it has a 64K buffer on TCP/IP.
That's part of why BitTorrent didn't get recognized. Because it was multiple TCP connections that running out of XP in that era. Mm. Okay. So it's actually much harder to see what I saw in that era than when Comcast was trying to find out why their network was dying than in my era.
I mean, I was stunned when I did some testing and found out that XP couldn't run faster than 30 megs. And I had to go off and think about it for a very long time before I found the answer, I must say.
So yep.
It just doesn't make sense, but that's it. That the operating system literally cannot go any faster no matter what you do. And then in Windows 2003, the problem was still the same, but it was driven because they treat the network driver as a serial interrupt. So everything's an NMI off the input. So the network adapter looks like a serial port, and every packet received or frame received off the NIC was treated as an NMI on the CPU. So it still couldn't throw data out, even though it had a better buffering algorithm. That's all fixed in 2008 and 2012, but still, you know, and the later versions of Vista and Windows 7. Windows 7 particularly has a very good algorithm for management, but it can buffer to the wacko, and that's causing our problems that we got here. Jim, we are going to have to wrap it up, I think. Here's an invitation, though, for you to come back and join us sometime in the future when Codel gets off the ground, or Codel, and we start to get more
It's already in the latest Linux releases, you understand.
Yeah, I do. But
FQCODL is just stupendous. We really love combining SFQ with CODL. It is just amazing.
And I'd like to thank you for joining us on the show this week. Where can people find you on the internet?
Well, if they can spell my name, I've always been pretty trivial to find.
search on Bufferbloat and you appear on every search.
Bloat, you can find me too. So.
Yeah. And we'll also have some links for you in the show notes. Mr. Michelle, what are you doing this week? Have you got something exciting planned?
More IPv6 yumminess.
For all definitions,
they changed the design on me again, so that's that'll be fun. Mm-hmm. And you can find me usually kvetching on the Twitter at Mrs. YSY, and of course blogging on Packet Pushers.
And what about you, Ethan? You causing more trouble this week?
So, trying to prevent some trouble. We're doing a VoIP rollout, and I need to deploy QoS to our MPLS endpoints and prioritize traffic for our voice and video conversations that are heading across our provider's MPLS cloud. So this was a timely conversation, although in my case, I know all the bandwidth and latency and everything, so I should be able to size my buffers appropriately. That'll be my goal. And anything I sort out that's worth blogging about, I'll blog that at packetpushers.net or tweet about it at ecbanks.
And, of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com or on the Twitters as at etherealmind. As always, you can leave your feedback about today's show on our website at packetpushers.net. You can contact us on the emails at packetpushers@gmail.com. Follow us on the Twitter as at packetpushers. As always, you can remember that too much networking would never be enough.